Well, you've no doubt been hearing some of the juicy morsels from the new book Game Change about the 2008 presidential campaign, morsels about Harry Reid and Sarah Palin and the Clintons and the Edwardses. We'll have both authors of the book in just a minute, and we'll get to a lot of it. But here's my Game Change gossip. The story from the book that has the most broken out is news. Harry Reid saying that thing about Obama's dialect and light skin. That one isn't even in the press release that came with my copy of the book. There's a list of bullet points of juicy morsels. That's not one. That's how much the media and the GOP seem to be willfully overinterpreting it. In case you missed it, Reid is quoted in the book saying he always thought Obama could win, partly because he's, quote, light-skinned and, quote, with no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one, unquote. Yesterday, Senator Reid went so far as to publicly apologize to the president for those remarks.
I've apologized to the president. I've apologized to everyone that, within the sound of my voice, that I could have used a better choice of words. And I'll continue to do my work for the African-American community. As a very young man in the state of Nevada, I was one of the leaders of the civil rights movement in Nevada, and it had a lot of moving to do. So I'm not going to dwell on this anymore. It's in the book. I've made all the statements that I'm going to. Thank you all very much.
It's in the book, Harry Reid. So let's start there. You want him, we got him. The authors of Game Change, John Heilman, New York Magazine political columnist, and Mark Halperin, senior political analyst for Time Magazine. Mark, John, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having us, Brian.
Brian, no book tour is complete without stopping to talk to you, so we're glad glad to get this done.
And I told Phil, it's kind of medicine that you have to take along. I told the listeners before the news that I was going to ask you this as the first question. Of all the revelations in your book, did you ever guess that this Harry Reid quote would be the one to break into the news cycle?
Well, it's funny because one of the things we thought was the biggest pieces of news in the book, and as you said, we've got a long list of things we thought might create news, was part of what Harry Reid was thinking about Barack Obama and the comments that have gotten so much attention. Harry Reid was part of a group of senators, and obviously the most prominent as the leader, who really were intrigued by Barack Obama, who thought he had a lot of political possibilities. And it went beyond just kind of idle musing. Harry Reid, as we describe in Game Change, called Barack Obama to his office and said, I want you to run for president. You should run. This was motivated, just as other senators, including Chuck Schumer of New York, were motivated by a desire to stop Hillary Clinton from being the Democratic nominee. They thought she would be a polarizing figure who would likely win the nomination, lose the general election, cost Democrats seats in the House and Senate, either because of her polarization or because, or a combination, of her husband's personal life and their worries about that. So we knew that the question of Harry Reid's musing about Barack Obama as a presidential candidate would hopefully make some news.
But as a racial controversy?
We did not anticipate that this would get quite as much attention.
And you attribute the quote to something he later said privately, or that's how you place it. John, did he say that directly to one of you?
You know, we've made a point in this, Brian. We've talked to over 200 people and done over 300 interviews. And in all cases, what we've done is we've said to people that our interviews would be on deep background, which meant that we wouldn't identify any of the sources for the book. And we've continued to stay with that. We haven't said whether or not we've spoken to Senator Reid or not, and we're going to stick with that line.
Okay. Can you say, as a matter of journalistic fact, as opposed to interpretation, what seems obvious to me, that Harry Reid was not saying anything racist about Barack Obama. He was analyzing the white electorate and stating a fact about Obama's range of speaking styles.
I think it is true that Harry Reid was making a political analysis. I think he used antiquated language, which obviously some people have found really offensive.
Just his use of the word Negro. That's the only part.
That seems to have struck some people out there as an offensive thing. But I do not think that he was he wasn't being denigrating towards Obama. He was thinking this in the context of why this man could become president, and it was, as you put it, in an analytical framework. I think that many objective analysts long before this controversy arose pointed to the fact that Barack Obama's that he was an unthreatening figure in American politics. And I think Harry Reid was identifying that, that he would be acceptable, and analyzing the electorate and what its tolerance was in making this assessment.
And Brian, so, and if I could say, Harry Reid wasn't just making a calculation, a sort of a bald political calculation about Obama's potential. He was personally excited, we learned in our reporting, about the prospect of Obama being America's first African-American president. So there's no doubt that to the extent he was making a racial comment, as John suggested, it was these thoughts of his were analytical and hopeful rather than negative.
So, Mark, do a little political analysis for us of the current moment. Why have the Republicans seized on this and exaggerated, I think it's fair to say, so much, even comparing it to Senator Trent Lott, saying the country would have been better off if segregationist Strom Thurmond was elected president, and we have the African-American RNC chairman, Michael Steele, out making this comparison, which I think they must actually realize is false on its face, and then Harry Reid going so far as to publicly apologize for something that he probably doesn't think he needs to apologize for.
Well, I'll put my political analyst hat on and answer, but I have to plead for some sort of handicap
for
privilege
being out of
because
the game, writing
the
book.
We're so focused on the book. Look, the Republican Party has been frustrated by the inability, for instance, to stop health care. And this gives them a way to rally to go after the leader in the Senate, who's also already before this controversy was facing a tough political fight at home. And I think to the extent that they can paralyze Reid, to the extent that they can get Democrats to have to play defense to keep Harry Reid propped up, which the White House and the Democratic Party is doing, they're less likely to be able to get through health care, which the Republicans on political and substantive grounds would like to stop.
Brian, I would just only add, and we'd love to move off this topic, but
and we will right after this answer.
I would only add the one thing we've obviously seen a lot of the news around this, and you know it is true Republicans are trying to exploit this, and it's true they're trying to capitalize on it for political reasons. It's also true that there are African Americans around the country who are actually offended by it, and who feel like this is the language of a bygone era, and who feel like that Harry Reid has shown himself to be, as I say, using antiquated language, have antiquated racial attitudes. There are people who legitimately feel that out there, and there it's not just the Republicans who feel as though there might have been that he might have stepped over the line.
John Heilman and Mark Halperin, authors of Game Change, Obama and the Clintons, McCain and Palin, and the Race of a Lifetime. And listeners, you've been seeing these guys on television. You've been hearing about the book. We will take your phone calls for them. But yesterday we talked at length and we took phone calls and we talked to an African-American linguist about whether this was a racist comment. Let's not do that. Your questions for them about the book and the various pieces of reporting in the book, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, if you want to talk to John Heilman and Mark Halperin, authors of Game Change. And I want to get back to what you said, Mark, was the main storyline here for the context of Harry Reid's remark, because to me this is the big news in the book, which is that many Democratic senators, Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer among them, thought that if Hillary won the nomination, she would lose the general election, at least in part, maybe in large part, you tell me, because Bill Clinton was having yet another affair. How big a factor do you think that was in all these senators coming out for Obama in 2007-2008?
It was a big factor. And, you know, this isn't a matter of us writing something, quote unquote, gossipy. This was a reality of American history. Hillary Clinton, former first lady, formidable presidential candidate. And the reality in the political world amongst not just her enemies, but more to the point, many of her supporters, former Clinton cabinet members, her campaign manager would make the rounds in Washington, would hear regularly, there are rumors about Bill Clinton. It even extended to the other side of the aisle. We have a scene in the book where John McCain is having lunch with a Democratic senator and says, what is Bill Clinton doing to his wife? They were concerned that Bill Clinton, whose past history made him put into question the notion of whether he might be having extramarital affairs or doing things untoward that could embarrass her.
How well documented was the alleged Bill Clinton affair?
Well, it was rumored widely. You may remember, Brian, in the spring of 2006, the New York Times wrote a very curious front page story about the state of the Clinton marriage. It was like one of the more elliptical pieces of reporting that the Times has done. It set off massive alarm bells in the Clinton orbit. They thought that the piece was trying to find a roundabout way to write about what was this gossip that was kind of running rampant in the Capitol. And it was, as Mark said, when serious people who were sympathetic to the Clintons started to worry about this, that news got back to Hillary Clinton. She heard about it. She hit the ceiling when she learned that people like former Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin was on conference calls worrying about, you know, someone needs to go confront President Clinton and tell him he has to stop or he's going to destroy her prospects of getting the nomination in the White House. Hillary Clinton found out about those calls. She was incredibly upset about them. But she also knew that it was a real political problem and she had to deal with it. And so as we report in Game Change, she assembled an inner circle. Three of her top advisors, Howard Wolfson, her communications advisor, Cheryl Mills, her lawyer, and Patty Solice Doyle, who would be her campaign manager, and created what we call a war room within a war room to get ready to deal with the fallout if this if stories came out about Bill Clinton's personal life, and further to investigate whether or not they were true. And we report in the book that they eventually came back to her and told her that they believed that in one case there was truth to the gossip, and that they needed to get ready if that ever became public.
Did Hillary consider finally dumping Bill and running in that context?
Quite the contrary, at least according to our reporting. I mean, it's possible that there'd be better data on this than we were able to get. But quite the contrary, she told her people to go to their battle stations and be ready to deal with this if this or any other aspect of his personal life became public. And of course, although President Clinton played a relatively minor role, in fact, surprisingly minor role, we found in 2007, once he decided to get involved in late 2007 and then into 2008, doing a pretty famous interview we write about in the book with Charlie Rose, where he took on Obama and then campaigning hard for her in Iowa, New Hampshire, and beyond. He got very involved and very invested, and the two of them worked as they have for years as a team, standing up against those who said Hillary should quit the race, standing up against those who argued for other strategies than the ones the Clintons wanted to pursue.
And forget Harry Reid. The real racist comment you reveal in the book came from the lips of Bill Clinton about Barack Obama speaking to Ted Kennedy, of all people.
Well, I mean, we report in the book that after the Iowa caucuses, Bill Clinton made a phone call to Ted Kennedy. Ted Kennedy had not endorsed in 2007, largely because his friend Chris Dodd was still in the race and he was not going to endorse anybody. We report on how Kennedy was drifting towards Obama throughout 2007, in no small part because the women in his life, his wife Vicky, his niece Caroline, were drifting towards Obama. After the Iowa caucuses, Chris Dodd was now out of the race. Kennedy's endorsement was in play. Bill Clinton was apoplectic at his wife's third place finish in Iowa and thought that one way to staunch the bleeding would be to secure the Kennedy endorsement. He gets on the phone with him the day after the Iowa caucuses and they have a very contentious phone call at the end of which he says to Kennedy, he says, you know, a few years ago, this guy, referring to Obama, would have been getting us coffee. Now, you know, you called that a clearly racist comment. There are people who have read that comment and thought that what he was doing was denigrating Obama's youth and inexperience. Ted Kennedy heard that as having a negative racial overtone and was mm-hmm. enraged by the comment. And it was the beginning of a series of phone calls by which he then rapidly moved into Obama's arms. Ted Kennedy's interpretation was different, though, than what some other people think is perfectly innocent.
It could have just been the role of a rookie.
Correct.
In the Senate, that those are the people who run coffee for the more senior senators.
Correct.
So to give that benefit of the doubt, at least a possibility.
Right. And we don't offer an interpretation in the book.
Tell us more about Chuck Schumer's role, because as senator from New York, and here we are on a New York radio station, wasn't he publicly supporting Clinton for the Democratic nomination?
Well, he was an endorser of Hillary Clinton, and make no mistake, he worked hard for her, doing fundraising, campaigning on her behalf, offering the campaign advice, lending some of his advisors to her. But behind the scenes, early on in 2006, he was part of a group of senators like Harry Reid, some others of whom also were public supporters of Hillary Clinton, who said to themselves, we need another horse in this race. We need to stop Hillary Clinton from being the nominee. Schumer, at one point, physically double-teamed Obama with Harry Reid to talk to him about running for president. Schumer, yesterday, as I understand it, acknowledged that, in fact, he had talked to Barack Obama about running for president. He passed it off as something any senator would do for another colleague who was thinking about it. The truth is Chuck Schumer is an extraordinarily astute politician. He was heading at the time the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, charged with getting Democrats elected to the Senate, increasing their numbers of seats. And he saw in Obama, even before Obama was elected to the Senate, he was raising money for other Democrats. He raised money for Tom Daschle in 2004, even though he hadn't been elected, because he had so much ease raising money for himself, building huge crowds. And what Schumer saw, and all these other Democrats, was Obama going to places like Nebraska, northern Florida, red parts of the country, and raising money and building huge crowds, the kind of thing Hillary Clinton, frankly, could not do.
Is that the game change?
Well, it's one of the biggest game changes in the book, because the mythology, which we believed along with everybody else, was that Hillary Clinton was the establishment candidate, that Obama was going to have to run this underdog ragtag campaign with grassroots support, but without establishment support. Many people held back their public support, but Obama decided to run and went forward comfortable, safe in the knowledge that a lot of establishment support was secretly for him.
Did Schumer just secretly – well, he had rivalries with Hillary Clinton when they were both in the Senate, right? I mean, he's the senator from New York, but she got all the attention.
There's no question that Chuck Schumer had a tough adjustment to, although being the senior senator, being one who was regularly overshadowed, and that their personal relationship at times early on was very rocky. It got better, and I believe that his secret support for Obama was based far more on political calculation and what he thought would be good for the Democratic Party than it was on the lingering animus with Hillary.
Mark Halperin, who is just speaking, and John Heilman, authors of Game Change, my guests on WNYC, 212-433-WNYC, or, of course, post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Mary in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hello, Mary.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. I would just like to ask, I just read this morning on Salon.com that Glenn Greenwald takes the book to task a little bit for, the amount of unattributed facts and some of the more, I think, as he says, sort of extraordinary claims. And I'm just wondering what the authors think about that and, you know, maybe could say why readers should trust or believe what's in the book if a lot of the claims are unattributed.
John, lots of anonymous sources.
Well, I mean, we did the entire book, as we said before. You know, we gave people these deep background assurances. I mean, part of the thing is Mark and I have been covering politics for a long time. We knew a lot of these people. The vast majority of them were people that we had longstanding relationships with. And, you know, we thought it was really important to be able to give a picture of the campaign and the candidates that was not the story behind the story. In order to get that level of cooperation and they get that level of intimacy, we told people that we would keep their names out of the book. But what we did not do was in any way relax our standards in terms of how well-sourced the book is. And I think, you know, to those who have questions about this, I think it's worth noting that as of today, beyond one denial by Liz Cheney of a piece of information that was attributed to her father, there's not been a single fact in the book that's been disputed by any of the characters who are in play. No one has taken us to task on anything specific. And we stand by every piece of reporting in the book, and it remains unchallenged largely, as I say, with the exception of Liz Cheney.
If I could just add to John's excellent explanation a couple things. One is that this is not some unorthodox method. This is a method used by many people in doing reporting, and it serves the public interest because the kinds of things we were able to learn to reveal about history, which otherwise we believe would have been lost to history as people's memories faded, would not be revealed if people weren't given the comfort of being able to describe events that they witnessed and participated in with the anonymity.
Did you stick to a two-source standard for things? That's a tradition in journalism that has somewhat broken down in recent years.
Everything in the book is sourced to our satisfaction. If someone who's running for president tells you directly, Brian, I was really angry at Hillary Clinton at that moment.
But they don't want their name attached.
But they don't want their name. Does that require a second source? No. So the two-source rule is important in many cases, but it's not always essential.
Mary, are you satisfied?
Oh, I appreciate the answer.
Thank you very much. Deborah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. I'm just turning off my radio.
That's okay. With another criticism that we're getting several people wanting to chime in with. Go ahead.
From the New York Times Review, you have not said anything remotely good about any woman connected to the campaign. And I'm wondering if that's true. It certainly seems from the quotes you have the most outrageous adjectives directed at the women in the book.
I'd say two things about that. One is the reporting in the book is not our opinion. It's based on, as John said, over 300 interviews with many people. And so we're describing what these sources who are familiar with the events. I think our portrait of Hillary Clinton, our portrait of Michelle Obama, are both, just to choose two examples, very positive and balanced, and you'll learn things about them that I think show them to be quite admirable figures. We have no animus towards anybody we wrote about in the book. Quite the contrary. These are people who put themselves out in the public sphere, work hard, and try to make the country a better place, and we have respect and admiration for all of them.
So the portrait of Elizabeth Edwards is perhaps not just what the New York Times reports?
And let's talk about that. And I think the portrait of Elizabeth Edwards and, frankly, the portrait of Sarah Palin are the ones where I think women are upset. And so, for example, and we'll get to Elizabeth Edwards, but not to defend Sarah Palin's politics one way or another, but the kinds of things you and your sources tag her with in this book could be seen by many women as sexist. Another woman's mental stability question for showing any emotion at all, as she did on the day after the Katie Couric interview when she was getting made up for something else and she was angry and frustrated and she smeared her makeup off and she tousled her hair. Oh, my God, send her to Bellevue for that.
Well, that's an inaccurate description of what we've done, for one thing, Brian. I mean, we describe the scene around the Katie Couric interview. That is certainly true. We also describe the McCain, many of McCain's senior advisors having a point of view about her, not in that moment, but in a moment several days later when she's doing her debate prep. And these were people who were charged with preparing her for a debate with Vice President Biden. They observed her. They observed what they described to us as her being in a nearly catatonic state. They were so concerned that they called headquarters and needed to alert ultimately John McCain that they had concerns about whether she was in a proper mental state to be able to succeed in her debate with Joe Biden.
And I understand, because I read that part carefully, that that's the sources close to McCain who are having those perceptions. You didn't, to my eye, raise the question that they may have been sexist and writing off a woman having a very normal reaction to a very extreme situation
Our sources on that story and every other story in the book are both men and women. I can't think of a single story related to Sarah. I know there's not a single story related to Sarah Palin we report anywhere in the book that is based on male sources exclusively.
And I would extend that to Elizabeth Edwards.
Well, I mean, absolutely.
There are almost no stories in the book. I can't do a catalog in my head right now. But among the people in the Edwards inner circle, many of those people were women. And many of the people who talked to us for the book were women. And many of the people who offered some very, very harsh assessments of Elizabeth Edwards were the women around her. Some of them were very sympathetic to Elizabeth Edwards. They considered her a courageous figure. They considered her a sympathetic figure. But they also saw this other side of Elizabeth Edwards that was not part of the public persona. And we do, in fact, report about that in the book.
And certainly there are many men who do not come off well in this book.
I would say.
John Edwards, not the least of which. Chuck Schumer and others.
Brian, you're very learned. What's the male equivalent of misogynist?
The male, what's the word?
Yeah, what's the word?
Oh, somebody's going to have to help us on that
one.
I'm not that learned.
All right, because
Jody,
I
think our producer Jody may have it. Jody, you have it? Okay, you're looking it up.
You make a good point. You know, if people say, well, the book's misogynist, it'd be interesting to see if anybody thinks it's too anti-man.
Well, it's certainly hard on John. Just give us like 30 seconds because we're running out of time on the Elizabeth Edwards reporting, because she, I guess you're saying compared to her public persona, she did not come off well, I guess, with respect to their private life.
I think we were astonished to learn, as we reported this book, the extent to which it was a unanimous view among people in the Edwards world, and by that I say John Edwards' staff and Elizabeth Edwards' staff, that there was no figure that in public life for whom the gap between public image and private reality was so great. Elizabeth Edwards treated her staff and his staff badly, and she treated her husband badly, and we report about it in the book. She referred to him as a hick. She referred to his family as rednecks. When she demeaned his intellectual capacity, when people would say, John, have you read a certain book? She would laugh and say, I'm the one who reads books. He doesn't read books. This was not something where we were weighing two competing sets of views about Elizabeth Edwards. The view was universal. She was very, very tough to live with, and she was very, very tough on the people around her.
And Amy in Manhattan, the female equivalent of misogynist is?
Misandry.
Wow.
Yep.
Yes, the person would be a misandrist.
Wow.
And our crack research team concurs.
We learn something new every day.
There you go. So before you go, one other criticism of the book. You're getting knocked around a little in the media for the gossipy nature of your book, because so much of it is about people's personalities and people's personal relationships, like the Edwards, rather than things that affect the lives of regular Americans. Why should we care about some of these things?
If you want to read a policy book, there are plenty of others, and we read them all the time. We're not against policy books, but you know, we sold this book before we finished it to HBO as a movie, because HBO recognized what we hope the book demonstrates, which is this was filled with extraordinarily interesting Americans with complicated and sometimes difficult relationships who just happened to be involved in running for president. Interesting people doing interesting things. We thought that was a really compelling story with novelistic, elements, all factual, but a great story to tell. We think that's a good part of American history, the most exciting campaign of a lifetime, as we say in the subtitle. We don't think there's anything wrong with that. Gossip is sort of out there, unverified. Everything in the book is verified and solid. Interesting, sometimes personal, sometimes a little hard to read, but the real lives of real people who were famous and doing a difficult thing.
The book is Game Change, Obama and the Clintons, McCain and Palin, and the Race of a Lifetime. John Heilman and Mark Halperin, thank you both very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Did you hear that thing that Britt Hume said about Tiger Woods and Buddhism and Christianity? We'll play that in a minute. We'll talk to Krista Tippett from Public Radio, Speaking of Faith, to actually compare Buddhism, Christianity, and forgiveness, and we'll take some phone calls. Stay tuned.